Welcome to the September issue of the JAS Unplugged podcast. I'm your host for the 2021-2022 season, Dr. Stephanie Pierce. I'm the recent vice chair of the AAOS Resident Assembly, and I just started my practice in pediatric sports, congenital hand, and hip preservation in Virginia Beach at the Children's Hospital of the King's Daughters. We know everyone enjoyed being back in person for the recent AAOS annual meeting in sunny San Diego. We are now all looking forward to the 2022 meeting in Chicago, March 22nd to the 26th. ICL's Tech Talks and Symposia submissions are due October 1st. This month, we will discuss revision ACL reconstruction key points, pearls, and techniques with authors Dr. Mark Miller from University of Virginia and Dr. Courtney Quinn from Inova Sports Medicine. We explore how a simple initiative to decrease time to antibiotic prophylaxis for open fractures is durable after 2 years. We learn all about popliteal artery entrapment syndrome, a diagnostic and treatment enigma for orthopedic surgeons. And we'll finish up with the management of humeral and glenoid bone defects in reverse shoulder arthroplasty. Let's jump right in. This podcast is brought to you by Zimmer Biomet. Precisely personalized. Zimmer Biomet's ROSA hip system is the newest addition to the ROSA robotics platform. Designed to seamlessly adapt to a surgeon's existing workflow, ROSA hip aims to assist direct anterior surgeons with preparation, positioning, and component impaction while intraoperatively quantifying cup orientation, leg length, and offset. For more information, please visit zimmerbiomet.com/rosahip. Our first article to review is a research article out of the September 15th issue titled "A Simple Initiative to Decrease Time to Antibiotic Prophylaxis for Open Fractures is Durable After 2 Years" by authors Avi Goodman, Jacob Modest, Joey Johnson, and Roman Haida. We all know, although prompt antibiotic administration is one of a few interventions that reliably decreases risk of infection after open fractures, systemic barriers tend to stand in the way. Recent studies have shown giving antibiotics within 60 to 65 minutes of injury has a notable benefit of reducing infection. The authors of this article instituted an open fracture antibiotic protocol where all open fracture patients were given antibiotics within 60 minutes of presentation. The protocol is best seen visually on page 3 in figure 1, so I encourage all of you to look at the original article. However, it focuses on education by the orthopedic surgery department to the providers, stressing the importance of prompt identification of open fractures and appropriate treatment. This education was then transferred to the emergency department after initial education. Additionally, education of nurses by nursing managers was supported. Flyers were posted in the critical care areas, including trauma bays. Triage was initially performed by the attending physician seeing the patient first. The pharmacy contributed by having premixed antibiotics ready to go for all trauma patients with 2 grams of premixed cefazolin, or for penicillin allergic patients, clindamycin was premixed and ready. Finally, involving the emergency medical record or emergency health record by creating an automatic order set for antibiotics, requiring explicit accept or deny orders for antibiotics on all trauma patients. The authors implemented this new protocol in the spring of 2016. They observed 50 consecutive patients that were followed pre-implementation of this protocol, as well as 50 consecutive patients that were followed July through September 2016, which is considered the post-implementation group. And now in this article, looking at a third set of 50 consecutive patients followed July through September of 2018, which was known as the retention group. This retention group was evaluated after a 2-year time period without re-education by the orthopedic department. Variables that were tracked include injury date, location, mechanism of injury, Castillo-Anderson type and classification, the injury severity score, patient age, and sex were all collected. Additionally, the primary outcome measure was time to antibiotic administration, and this was also broken down into time from presentation to the antibiotic order, as well as time from the antibiotic order to antibiotic administration. The results: no difference was seen between the pre-intervention, post-intervention, and retention groups for age, sex, ISS, or injury severity score, mechanism of injury, Gustilo-Anderson classification or location of fracture. There was a significant difference that was seen for time from presentation to antibiotics. The pre-implementation group to the post-implementation group improved from 123 minutes to 35-minute time period for antibiotic administration. The retention group 2 years later after the first education implementation was still at 50 minutes from presentation. This was significantly different from the pre-intervention group, although it was slightly higher from the immediate post-intervention group, but it was still within that 1 hour time period. The proportion of patients receiving antibiotics within 60 minutes significantly increased from 46% in the pre-intervention group to 82% in the post-intervention group, and this continued at 80% for the retention group. Looking at time from presentation to antibiotic order, this decreased from 94 minutes in the pre-intervention group to 26 minutes in the post-intervention group and held close by at 32 minutes for the retention patients. Looking at time from antibiotic order to administration, this decreased from 29 minutes pre-intervention to 9.5 minutes in the post-intervention group and time period, and still to 17 minutes during the retention group time period. In conclusion, the open fracture protocol at Brown University, combining interventions from orthopedic trauma, surgery, emergency medicine, pharmacy, and information technology, was effective in timely administration of antibiotics and showed lasting durable changes at the 2 year mark without continued time intensive didactics from the orthopedic trauma team. This was a great review of a successful protocol that was implemented with education, visual signage, and EMR hard stop, showing how powerful these can be. This is easily a take home methodology we could use in various aspects as we all try and implement different protocols to improve the patient safety at our own institutions. Our next article to review is a review article out of the September 1st issue titled Popliteal Artery Entrapment Syndrome, a Diagnostic and Treatment Enigma for Orthopedic Surgeons. Authors are Timothy Miller, Rose Bax, and Patrick Vaccaro. Popliteal Artery Entrapment Syndrome, or PAES, is an often unrecognized cause of chronic leg pain that is diagnosed most often in running athletes, such as distance runners and military personnel. Reviewing the anatomy of the popliteal fossa, it is a diamond-shaped area located at the posterior aspect of the knee and allows passage of neurovascular structures from the thigh to the leg. The muscular borders are the semimembranosus superomedially, the biceps femoris superolaterally, the medial head of the gastrocnemius inferomedially, and the lateral head of the gastrocnemius and plantaris inferolaterally. Its contents, from medial to lateral, include the popliteal artery, the popliteal vein, the tibial nerve, and the common peroneal nerve. It's important as we go through the diagnosis and treatment algorithm discussed in this article. There are two main types of popliteal artery entrapment syndrome that have been described, one being anatomic and one being functional. The anatomic variant is due to an anatomic restriction in blood flow or ischemia. It's an isolated lower extremity ischemia in young adults without peripheral vascular disease or a cardiac history. The anatomic version typically requires more aggressive treatment with surgical intervention indicated. The functional variant occurs during a causative activity, such as running on inclines or repetitive jumping. It tends to present as cramping to the upper calf, as well as paresthesias to the plantar foot. Overall presentation for popliteal artery entrapment syndrome usually has the patient's mean age in the early 30s. Men are more common than women, mostly due to increased calf musculature. Some athletes describe their symptoms to be improved as running continues, unlike the close counterpart of chronic exertional compartment syndrome. In terms of a workup, first line is an X-ray to rule out fracture, stress fracture, or neoplasm. Step two is a T3 MRI, and this is to rule out soft tissue conditions such as muscle strains, Achilles tendinopathy, medial tibial stress syndrome, stress fractures, and sarcomas. The MRI may also show fascial herniations of the muscle and may be used with ultrasound to diagnose popliteal artery entrapment syndrome. overall, the beginnings of the workup for these patients is to help rule out any and all causes of lower extremity pain. Along with this are labs to rule out systemic causes of leg pain, such as sickle cell disease, rhabdomyolysis, low ferritin levels, and low vitamin D levels. Leg compartment pressures can be considered with a slit catheter or needle mammometry during or after exercise to rule out exertional compartment syndrome, which is considered to be more common than popliteal artery entrapment syndrome. To review those numbers, greater than 15 millimeters of mercury at rest, greater than 30 millimeters of mercury at 1 minute post-exercise, and greater than 20 millimeters of mercury at 5 minutes post-exercise is indicative of exertional compartment syndrome. An EMG should be considered to evaluate entrapment of common peroneal nerve branches if other testing is inconclusive, and then the vascular workup, which helps actually diagnose the popliteal artery entrapment syndrome. So if all other diagnoses are excluded, a duplex ultrasound and post-exercise CTA or MRA are almost 100% sensitive and greater than 80% specific for popliteal artery entrapment syndrome. It is diagnosed by seeing arterial stenosis, obliteration of the lumen, and post-stenotic dilation. Preoperative planning for popliteal artery transposition or gastrocnemius band resection, also known as myotomy, is performed with a catheter-based contrast arteriography during passive dorsiflexion and active plantar flexion. An excellent image of this appears in the paper in Figure 4. In terms of treatment, initial treatment is conservative, like most things in orthopedics: rest, decreased training volume and intensity, gastrocnemius and soleus stretching, massage, adaptive footwear, anti-inflammatories, and physical therapy. If these don't work or symptoms continue to worsen, one option of non-surgical treatment includes vasoactive medications and Botox. These are fairly experimental, but they're helpful to avoid or delay surgery. Most of the vasoactive medications are used for peripheral arterial disease, and they're experimental, some of them not even approved by the United States FDA. These include cilostazol, pentoxifilin, and naftadofuran oxalate. Botox A is injected into the medial or lateral gastroc head at the site of maximal arterial occlusion. The mechanism is thought to decrease the volume of the gastrocnemius muscle. While we're still very early in understanding of the long-term outcomes, short-term follow-up has shown to have symptom-free periods for greater than 1 year. And in another study, 4 out of 5 athletes were symptom-free for 14 to 50 months. In terms of surgical intervention, for anatomic popliteal artery entrapment syndrome, surgical intervention is indicated and is indicated early to correct the aberrant anatomy, even if symptoms are mild. This is due to the risk of progression of arterial occlusion. The goal for all surgical interventions is to restore the normal relationship of the popliteal artery and the medial head of the gastrocnemius. Referral to a vascular surgeon is necessary when planning definitive treatment. 2 main surgical interventions include popliteal artery decompression. This can be combined with transposition of the popliteal artery with vascular repair or with saphenous vein bypass grafting. A posterior approach is taken with an S or Z-shaped incision to expose the popliteal fossa anatomy. Techniques include 1 of 3, myotomy of medial head of the gastrocnemius or popliteus, excision of an aberrant branch of the gastrocnemius, or debulking of surrounding musculature. One study showed an average of 7.6 centimeters cubed was needed to fully debulk their 36 athletes to have a significant outcome. Another surgical approach would be decompression with arterial reconstruction with bypass grafting. This is indicated when the popliteal artery has stenosed, fibrosed, or developed an associated aneurysm. This is usually for long-standing cases. Surgical results of release with reconstruction by Leger et al. Showed 84% remain patent at an 82-month follow-up. And results from Keene et al. Showed 75% bypass graft patencies at 5 years follow-up. Both of these cohorts showed decreased patency when lesions extended beyond the popliteal artery. In terms of the postoperative rehab protocol, Weight bearing is tolerated beginning on post-op day number one with either a knee immobilizer or a hinge knee brace for a week. Physical therapy is then recommended to be commenced at 1 week postoperatively to begin calf strengthening and gait training. Return to running with arterial transposition or vascular repair is recommended at the 4 to 6 week mark with full release after 6 weeks. If bypass grafting occurs, then return to running doesn't occur until after 3 months. For DVT prophylaxis, 325 milligrams of aspirin POQ day for 6 weeks is recommended. And if symptoms recur for a patient, evaluation of the graft patency by duplex ultrasound is the method of choice. In summary, popliteal artery entrapment syndrome is a diagnostic challenge and can be frustrating for both patient and surgeon. This article gives a great rundown of the diagnosis, workup, and treatment for patients. Distinguishing features include calf cramping, coolness of the posterior leg, and plantar paresthesias. Benchmark diagnosis is with MRA with either maximal passive ankle dorsiflexion or active ankle plantar flexion or after exercise provocation. Ultimately, surgery is usually needed, especially for the anatomic variant, but techniques yield satisfactory results with positive return to sport rates. Our final article to review is out of the September 1st issue titled Management of Humeral and Glenoid Bone Defects in Reverse Shoulder Arthroplasty, authors Lisa Friedman and Grant Garagese. Shoulder pain is a common problem for which reverse total shoulder arthroplasty is a reliable and durable treatment with an expanding number of indications. However, in the setting of glenoid or humeral bone loss, shoulder arthroplasty becomes more challenging with a higher risk of complications. Bone loss can lead to loosening. Quality bone stock is needed, even more so in reverse total shoulder arthroplasty implants versus anatomic total shoulder arthroplasty due to the semi-constrained nature of the implant and reliance on the length-tension relationship of the surrounding musculature. In terms of humeral bone loss, causes are numerous, which include aseptic or septic loosening, osteolysis, stress shielding, extracting primary implants, and oncologic resection. Classifications are based on the proximal humeral arthroplasty revision osseous insufficiency classification system, which primarily describes bone loss, but it is associated with treatment approaches. Type 1 and 2 are associated with greater tuberosity fixation. Types 2 and 3 are associated with structural humeral bone grafting needs. And type 3 is associated with proximal humerus or total humeral replacement. In terms of treatment, two main options. One is allograft prosthetic composite or APC. Benefits of using an allograft prosthetic composite include decreased torsional loads that are present at the modular junctions of a modular component. The allograft prosthesis improves filling the subdeltoid space to reestablish the deltoid wrapping effect in that length-tension relationship. Additionally, allograft prosthetic composites can provide attachment sites for tendons, which is especially needed in oncologic cases, to enhance stability, motion, and strength. Cons for allograft prosthetic composite include complications involving graft resorption and failure of incorporation, donor-to-host transmission of disease, which is extremely rare but possible, and of course, the high cost of such an implant. The second type of solution we have for humeral bone loss currently is endoprosthetic reconstruction or megaprosthesis. Benefits of this type of implant include being simpler to implant, technically, no reliance on bony healing, and therefore decreased risk of mechanical complication. Additionally, it allows for a possible total humeral replacement if it's needed, as it can be combined with total elbow replacement. Cons of the megaprosthesis, less tendon reattachment sites, only limited to holes. In terms of glenoid bone loss, causes include primary osteoarthritis, rotator cuff arthropathy, and revision arthroplasty. Classifications used are mostly the Antuna classification, which takes into account both the location of wear and its severity. More treatment options exist for glenoid bone loss. Five are listed throughout this article, which include glenoid bone grafting, usually using a humeral head autograft during a primary reverse total shoulder, as the humeral head autograft is readily available. Other options include iliac crest autographed in a revision situation or other graph sources. Number two are glenoid augments. These can bolster the area of the glenoid with a bone deficiency. Posterior and superior augments are seen to be the safest, as neither augment was seen to dislocate or need a revision in two different studies. Number three is custom patient-specific technology. Custom glenoid base plate is a patient-specific approach using computer-assisted design and manufacturing to create a base plate unique to the patient's glenoid bone loss. Number four is navigation. Using optical tracking system to determine location and orientation of the central guide pin to help maximize implanting the base plate to help find the maximal bony support. And lastly, alternative central line. This involves aligning the axis of the junction of the scapular spine and the scapular body to allow for more robust fixation in those with notable glenoid erosion. Glenoid and humeral bone loss is an important problem in reverse total shoulder arthroplasty. When left unaddressed, it can lead to early failure of the implant and poor outcomes. Understanding methods to minimize bone loss and increase healing will allow better outcomes and longevity for these patients. Hello, and welcome to the interview portion of the September issue for the JOS Unplugged podcast. Today we have Dr. Mark Miller and Dr. Courtney Quinn on the podcast to learn more about their review article from the September 1st release, Anterior Cruciate Ligament Revision Reconstruction. Welcome, guys. Why don't you introduce yourselves to our listeners and then tell us why you pursued this topic and review the article?
Yeah, hi, I'm Mark Miller from the University of Virginia. I've been involved with revision ACL reconstruction from its outset. In fact, I've been doing this for 25 years and revisions have been coming to me for that whole time. And a lot of people do ACLs and not everybody does them right. And that's why it's been my challenge and my privilege over my career to develop techniques to help deal with these patients.
And my name is Courtney Quinn. I was a fellow with Dr. Miller at the University of Virginia for my sports fellowship and owe much of my knowledge and experience so far to him. And I'm very proud and humbled to be included as part of this paper and part of the podcast. I am now working in practice in Northern Virginia with the Inova Health System.
Wonderful. Well, we're so excited to have you both here today. We just want to kind of go through your article in detail so our listeners can kind of learn all of the knowledge that you have to give and share with us. And so your article does a phenomenal job doing a review of what to do with a patient with a re-tear of an ACL. Dr. Quinn, could you kind of walk us through how you evaluate and image a patient that comes into your clinic today? You're suspecting an ACL re-tear and how the listeners and myself should frame how we approach that patient.
Sure. I think that the kind of primary thing to understand about dealing or kind of evaluating patients who have had a prior ACL reconstruction for a possible graft failure is that it's very multifaceted. And there's many elements of the history, exam, and imaging that need to be considered because there's a lot of different reasons that the graft can fail. And it's important as the surgeon and evaluating physician to understand all those reasons and make sure you're covering all your bases. And so I think the understanding, so how long out are they from their surgery? So we know that some grafts can fail in the very early stages. So within a year of after original reconstruction, some can be many years later. And so understanding where in the graft incorporation process the re-injury occurred, if you can identify an inciting event, that is very important to know because it can give you a hint as to what may have caused the failure. So getting obviously a full history and physical or history of understanding, was there an event or was it just that over time, many years later, the knee has just kind of felt loose and isn't really acting right? And so understanding those parts of the history is very important. So a mechanism of injury, and then their current symptoms. And in terms of physical exam, I think that obviously this is a very important part of the process. And one thing that we're coming to appreciate is seeing the patient from a very dynamic standpoint. And so this is not just a physical exam that takes place on the table. We like to kind of see the patient walking, see their gait, see if they've got a varus or valgus thrust, see their overall leg positioning, because we take that into account when we look at overall alignment or possible neglected concomitant injuries with the primary surgery or other injuries that they've sustained since the primary surgery. And so understanding how they function as a dynamic patient. And so watching them walk, like I said, and getting a greater sense of how they move. And then obviously getting them up on the table and doing a full bilateral knee exam, comparing it to the contralateral side and doing a full ligamentous exam. So not just checking a Lachman and anterior drawer or pivot shift, but also checking for varus and valgus instability or injury to the PCL, and then assessing for possible meniscal injuries as well on exam is very important. And so that's part of the primary kind of office visit. In terms of imaging, plain films are very important. So weight-bearing x-rays of obviously the affected knee. If there's a suspicion for malalignment, getting standing full-length leg films is very important as well to assess for varus or valgus deformity of the proximal tibia or distal femur that can give you an overall limb malalignment, as well as we're beginning to really appreciate the role of posterior tibial slope and what role that can play with ACL graft failure, both at the primary and revision setting. And so checking out the lateral x-ray, and that's most accurately done on plain films with a full-length tibial film, but you can still get accurate measurements on just a knee film if you don't have a whole lot of rotation. And we've seen that in a bunch of studies. And I think that's really imperative to get on every visit to make sure that you're definitely getting plain films. And then obviously, if you have a suspicion, then you'll go to advanced imaging, and an MRI is, you know, hands down absolutely necessary for evaluation of obviously the integrity of the ACL graft, as well as all of the concomitant injuries that could come along with it. So we're looking for the other collateral ligaments, PCL, meniscal injuries, as well as cartilage.
That's awesome. I think everything that you're talking about really highlights the importance of the thoroughness of the evaluation, as each of these patients really are unique to each other. And so it's not just a cookie cutter, oh, we have a revision ACL we need to do. You know, there are very different aspects that really trigger different points of their care and what treatments that they need in the future. So that's very, very helpful, very thorough and detailed approach to it. Dr. Miller, with all of your experience, what are your indications for single stage versus dual stage revision? So as we're taking these patients in and we're looking at all their nuances, just like Dr. Quinn mentioned about there could be extra meniscal pathologies, extra cartilage injuries, how do you decide based on tunnel size? How do you decide based on concomitant pathology? When do you do a single stage? When do you do a two stage revision?
Right. Well, obviously the patients would prefer a one stage. And when you think you have to do a two stage, you have to be quite a salesman. It's very difficult. So we go into it trying to figure out if we can do a one stage. Unfortunately, if there's significant osteolysis, like more than 14 or 15 millimeters of diameter, then it's very difficult to do a single stage revision. This is particularly true if the current tunnels are somewhere near where your tunnels are ideally to be placed. And so you don't want to create extremely large tunnels. You don't want to create oval tunnels. You don't want to cause laxity in the construct. And so it's better to do a two-stage revision in some cases than a failed one-stage revision. You certainly don't want to go down the path of failure again. So there's a lot of factors involved. They include whether you need to do concurrent bone work, like Dr. Quinn mentioned, osteotomies, whether you need to address these huge osteolytic problems, whether you can do concurrent surgery at the same time. And then, you know, there's obviously factors for the patient as well, like where they are in their athletic season or their athletic career, when they can have time to do surgery, what their pain limitations and different parameters are, and a whole host of other considerations.
Absolutely. That makes a lot of sense. What about someone who needs an osteotomy and they have 15 or 16 millimeter size tunnels? Dr. Miller, what would you do with that?
Yeah, so we like to do our osteotomies at the same time as the first stage. That way we can get all the bone to heal, and then the revision is relatively easy because we've already done all the bone work. And so, yes, we do the osteotomies first, and at the same time, we can fill in the tunnels. This is nice because you don't have to worry about filling the tunnels and changing, you know, what you've done when you do the osteotomy. And so it's nice to plan that, and typically we do the osteotomy first and then fill in the tunnels. And in fact, some of the bone you get from a anterior closing wedge osteotomy, you can use to fill in the tunnels.
It's a great bone graft, autograft. How long do you usually stage that then?
Yeah, it's typically 4 months. And so what we like to do is to repeat the CT to see how well our bone dowels have integrated. And we've done some work on this too, recently published, and I would encourage you to look at that. But in general, 4 months, longer in smokers, but a CT scan will define that for us.
Perfect. And then that's a bony alteration. What about with soft tissue? Say there's a bucket handle meniscus repair that you need to perform. Do you do that at the first stage or the second stage?
Yeah, well, sometimes you end up doing it both. The reason that's important is because you don't want to leave a bucket for a long 4 months. So in the same time, you don't want to leave a bucket with an ACL deficient knee. So you got to choose your poison. And in this case, we prefer to do it early, and then we may have to critically look at it at the time of revision and may have to repeat it. But otherwise, you're going to lose the meniscus.
Tough situations for sure. Dr. Quinn, you have a patient that comes in. She is a young athlete, very active, about 18 years of age. She had a previous ACL reconstruction with an allograft. We're talking about graft choice now. So they had an allograft. Anything on the table is yours. What is your preferred graft choice for that patient? 18-year-old active athlete female.
Yeah, so I think depends, I guess, a little bit on her physical exam, what her ligamentous laxity, her kind of inherent ligamentous laxity is, and exactly what her sport is. But I've been doing, since being in practice and doing a lot more of the quadriceps graft, I've been really happy with that. But I think the BTB is a really tried and true, cannot, in my opinion, really can't go wrong graft to choose. And I think depending on her otherwise ligamentous exam of the knee, I think I would probably discuss both of those with the patient and kind of talk about the pros and cons of each and let the patient decide. But pretty much those two. Many of us, I think the literature, at least in my opinion, is kind of pushing us away a little bit from hamstrings grafts, especially in young, active athletes. And so it's been used for many, many years. And certainly anyone who's using them is very valid in doing so, especially if you're doing it correctly. And it's not to knock it at all. But I think that there's been some literature that maybe it's not as good for these kind of young, active patients. And so for me, it's either a quad or a BTB. And generally in females, like I've been liking the quad.
I think the important thing for your audience to understand is to never use an allograft, either in a primary or revision setting for these young athletes. That's well known for primary surgery, but I'm not sure it's well known for revision surgery, but it should be known because the Mars group has taught us that. And so, yes, we prefer patella tendon and quad tendon autografts. I actually prefer quad with a bone block because I like the bone-to-bone fixation. So that's my preference.
I like the bone block on the quad as well. I think that bone-to-bone healing is just so appealing, and I'll use that all the way down into 12 and even 10-year-olds, depending on the size of their femoral condyle. So I agree with you. It's very appealing to have that. Wonderful. So let's move a little bit more towards the adjunctive procedures you guys talked about in your review article, or that extra-articular supplementation, really targeting in that anterior lateral complex. Dr. Quinn, I know you've done a lot of work on this with some of your research. What do you recommend in terms of LAT versus ALL reconstruction, and when do you like to do it?
Sure. So I don't have a lot of personal experience with ALL reconstruction myself using an allograft. Pretty much all of my experience in training and in practice has been with LAT using the modified Lemaire. And I think we're beginning to understand, thanks to a lot of the work that Dr. Getgood's group is doing, in addition to many other contributing authors, to understand the role of addressing that anterior lateral instability in high-risk patients. And so I think in the revision setting, because I think the debate of when to do it in the primary setting could be a long one, and I don't know if we know all the answers, but I think especially in the revision setting for young patients, so we classify young here as like about less than 25, but I think you kind of do a physiologic young there. And if your patient kind of fits that, depending on their activity level, and patients who are still very active, especially if they are playing high-risk sports, and I think have a high-grade pivot shift preoperatively. So a clunk or really kind of a locking is a good indication for us that this is more of a rotational instability element, more than just kind of an ACL missing. This is a larger injury. And so in those patients, I think adding that in the revision setting is, it doesn't take much to push me in that direction, because I think that you want to make sure that this is the final surgery you're doing for these patients. This is already number two. You don't want there to be a number three. So you kind of want to do everything you can.
Absolutely. And Dr. Miller, what do you think about with posterior slope in addition to that anterior lateral complex? There's been a lot of discussion on whether adding an LAT or an ALL reconstruction can add some of that rotary instability or help when there's an increased posterior tibial slope. Do you believe that that is the case? Do you think that there's kind of a cutoff that we haven't found yet? Or do you think we really need to hold true to that gold standard of the osteotomy?
Well, I think this is evolving, and I'm happy that both Dr. Quinn and myself are what I like to consider on the cutting edge of this. We are starting to do more and more of these. I think in general, if you have a tibial slope of more than 14 degrees, regardless of whether you do an LET or not, I think you should probably do an osteotomy, both in a revision and, I'm going to go out on a limb here, and in a primary setting. And so we're starting to do some primary osteotomies in people with these huge tibial slopes. And then in addition to that, there's probably a gray area, maybe 11 to 14, where an LET may be adequate in and of itself without going to the osteotomy. But we're still learning, and hopefully we'll have some answers for all of us soon.
Definitely agree. It's definitely an area where we're seeing a lot of explosion in research for good reason. I think it makes a really big difference. So hopefully we can get some more answers as we all keep working towards it. Maybe some of our listeners will help with that too. So moving on to rehab, I think this is an area where at least me getting ready to go into practice in this month, when we do which rehab protocols for which patient populations, as well as when do we do which rehab protocols, how do we modify it for a revision versus a primary versus a second revision, et cetera. Dr. Miller, does your rehab protocol change with a different patient population based on age, activity, or graft choice?
You know, the rehab is a fascinating story, and I've gone through the many different phases of this with Shelbourne's accelerated rehab, which I think was probably too accelerated. And so my approach is to do a decelerated rehab. In some of our studies at the University of Virginia with Return to Play, that includes both the STEP and the LEAP programs that it allow us to evaluate the strength and the function of the ACL, have taught us that really athletes shouldn't return to play until probably 9 or sometimes 12 months or longer. And so a decelerated rehabilitation is probably appropriate, particularly in a revision setting. So it's difficult to get these patients back at all, let alone the same level. And so I don't think you should be in a hurry.
That makes a lot of sense. Why rush into a third surgery if we can make sure everything is going in the right way, making sure we have the quadricep, everything else? Dr. Quinn, do you extend or keep the same for your rehab for a primary ACL reconstruction versus a revision?
No, I agree. I think especially with, you know, this being the second time around, generally patients are understanding. They really kind of understand the gravity of the situation and how they really don't want to push it and kind of do too much too fast. And so it's usually not a hard sell to slow things down slightly. You know, depending on the concomitant pathology that you have to address, then that will kind of change different elements of the rehab. But certainly, I think the big variables we understand are that, like Dr. Miller mentioned, that the return to play is really made probably longer than we expect. And I always kind of counsel for revisions that it's going to take them a little bit longer than the first time to get better, and that the overall outcomes, you know, with all patients, or that it's never really as good as a primary in terms of overall patient satisfaction scores. And so counseling them on that is important to begin with. Now, that's very highly variable depending on a lot of the age of the patient now, degree of arthritic changes, whether they've had a lot of other injuries or other pathology that had to be addressed at the same time. But they generally appreciate the need to go a little bit slower. And I think it's important for the overall health of the knee.
I think that's a great point too. You really touch on expectations and really making sure that the patient understands what are the expectations, how is it different from the first time around. You know, we all say, oh, you guys are a pro, you've been through this, but this time is different and we want it to have a different outcome too. So I think that that's huge, and that bedside manner of being able to really educate the patients in the right way.
I think we've all seen, you know, the sadness in the eyes of a patient who especially is a still active athlete who, when you have to tell them that they tore their ACL again, I mean, it's, they understand how devastating that is. And so it's definitely important to set expectations, and they, you know, set the goals for them and the time frame from the front so that they understand.
I'd like to emphasize also the importance of making sure the patients have extension post-op, both in a primary and a revision setting. It's devastating when people come late to me and don't have full extension, because that's a very difficult problem to overcome. So I'd like to encourage all of our audience to make sure that our patients are working on extension pre and immediately post-op.
That's a great point. That's one thing that I really gained from your article too, is that getting less than a 5-degree extension lag is critical before doing the second stage. And that's something that, you know, I wasn't totally aware of and makes logical sense. And I could see there being a lot of risk of losing the full motion if you don't have that before doing another big revision.
Yeah, I think any acute surgery is only going to decrease your motion immediately. And so if you're already starting with a flexion contracture of some degree, I can only expect that it's going to get at least in the immediate period, a little bit worse. And that's not the direction you want to go in. So you want to start with full extension and then work really hard and emphasize to the patient in the PACU that getting this knee straight is their primary goal for the next few days until they start PT or even starting PT. You know, I usually tell my patients to start post-op day one or post-op day three at the latest, but I give them a lot of instructions what to do when they go home and just make sure they're getting that knee straight.
Do you recommend full extension, 0 degrees, if at all possible? Or do you, like, how long will you wait in order to get to that 5 degree or less degree point, Dr. Quinn?
You mean if they have a pre-op extension deficit or of 5 degrees? I mean, I think that you don't want to obviously delay surgery too long if they have an unstable knee, because you're kind of trying to weigh a couple different factors here and play a little gamble of waiting too long to obviously to get the ball rolling and to get their rehab started postoperatively, but also the longer you wait, the more you have a higher risk of meniscal or cartilage lesions in the knee. So sending them to some prehab, so lining them up with a therapist to at least try for a few weeks. I think it's fine to wait up to 6 weeks after an injury to really try to maintain motion. If they're really not getting anything beyond 6 weeks or 2 months and it's been a while and they're not able to get it, then perhaps that there's an intra-articular process that's kind of blocking their motion. And that's something you can address at the time of surgery, but certainly you try to use physical therapy to kind of get their motion the best they can pre-op.
That's awesome. Dr. Miller, do you have any pearls or tricks to try and get that last bit of extension for these patients preoperatively or postoperatively?
Unfortunately, I have a lot of experience with people with loss of motion, but don't send me any more patients, please. So this is a difficult problem, and we've used some various different extension boards and extension devices. There's several commercially available devices to help do that. So I would encourage you to talk to your various brace reps and see what they have available. And those can be very helpful and requires a dedication by the patient. When they can't get it, we sometimes have to delay their revision and do a lysis of adhesions and manipulation under anesthesia with an extension dropout cast. And so those really delay things, very difficult to do. Loss of extension is a challenge, and that's why I encourage you to not go in with it.
And then one more kind of rehab question too, especially because I know you guys have written a lot of book chapters on ACL reconstructions, ACL reconstruction revisions. What about in the less talked about population of our pediatric patients? So say there's a 12-year-old male that comes in and he's already on his second, he has a re-tear, he needs a revision. How are you going to change his rehab protocol or add to it to help with the fact that they don't have that proprioception connection developed as well as our 20-year-old collegiate athlete, Dr. Miller?
Yeah, you just got to slow them down and mostly talk with the parents and try to do what you can to make your graft as strong as possible, including a backup. And it's tough, but you got to try to slow the patient down and get the family and the parents involved.
Do you mind if I interject and ask? I know you have a lot of experience with this in the pediatric population too. What are your thoughts on that? What do you like to do and add in? Is there any other tips that we can take away?
Absolutely. So I love the idea that Dr. Miller mentioned about really making sure that the graft has secure fixation, because it's going to have to be able to undergo more range of motion, more loading, more cyclical movement and landing, as well as multidirectional movement than our collegiate 20s, 30s, 40s, et cetera. And so we can only educate and contain so much. But I think more importantly, it's really getting their quads as strong as possible, as quickly as possible. And because they don't have that proprioceptive connection, using mirrors in physical therapy to help give them that biofeedback will help build that connection faster. And it also will help create a connection that's not there yet. So we'll use it a lot in our 8-year-olds and 10-year-olds and 12-year-olds to be able to try and say, oh, my knee's drifting into valgus, let's recorrect. I can at least see it, even if I can't feel it. And so making sure that we have some of that, as well as some really guided one-on-one physical therapy sessions. They need one-on-one more so than our older patients and athletes. They easily get distracted, if you will. And so they can easily drift into dangerous positions and motions. But just like you guys have mentioned, educating the parents, educating the patient itself, you know, sometimes the 12-year-old males seem extremely young and that they're not listening, but they can take pride and responsibility in their knee as well. So really empowering them to do so, I think makes a big difference.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes a lot of sense. And I think we can all agree that's probably the most challenging population to treat with in terms of revision ACL is these young kids who have already had one surgery and are now facing another. So that's great advice. And certainly goes back to the primary source of a lot of ACL injuries to begin with, which is neuromuscular control and, you know, strength and balance and everything. So
that's a
good reminder for all of our patients, right?
Yes, absolutely. And hopefully we can expand, just like we talked about with the anterolateral complex, hopefully we can expand some of the literature in that area too, and really looking at some biomechanical ways and neuromuscular ways of trying to help improve that population with their rehab postoperatively. Well, awesome. This has been a phenomenal interview. I really have enjoyed getting to pick both of your brains with all of your expertise. Like I said, to our listeners, in case you don't know, Dr. Miller and Dr. Quinn have written many chapters and articles on ACL reconstruction as well as revision ACL reconstruction. And we are so privileged to get to have them on the podcast today and help share their knowledge with us.
Well, thank you, Dr. Pearson. I'd also like to give a shout out to our third author, Michelle Q, who's doing her fellowship at the Hospital for Special Surgery right now. So thanks to her as well.
Absolutely. Thank you to Dr. Hugh. This is a huge collaborative effort, as every article is, and bit of literature. And so this is definitely one I'm keeping on my shelf to keep handy as I go through practice myself. So thank you both so much.
Thank you. Yes. And huge thank you to Michelle.
Thank you. And thank you to our audience. And thank you, Dr. Pierce.
And that concludes our September episode. We appreciate you tuning in. As fall is upon us and college football is in full swing, we look forward to you joining us next month as we cover preoperative peripheral nerve blocks in orthopedic trauma surgery, a guide to diagnosis-based treatment, conversion to total hip arthroplasty after hip arthroscopy, a population-based survivorship study with a minimum 2 years follow-up, osteosarcoma, an evolving understanding of a complex disease, and an in-depth interview on private equity and its emergence in orthopedics. Until next time, stay safe and see you soon.